It's the Barry Pod on 99.3 thevine.com.
This is the Barry Pod, recorded on the 6th of May, 2024. And in the pod with me this time is Peter Coyote.
What's left of him?
Seems to be quite a bit of you still. Thank you for doing the podcast.
Hey, you introduced me to my wife.
Oh, I did.
Well, I met Laura the day that you and I first met and did an interview for Joel Gallagher.
What a cool story that is. Yeah. And wedded bliss has followed.
Oh, yeah, we were married October 28th.
That's beautiful. So let's begin. And, you know, right up top, you are someone that I could probably happily chat with for 2 or 3 hours without repeating myself. But we don't have that much time, so we're going to just dive into this hard and fast. First of all, would you be happy or offended to be called a mensch?
No, I'm a Jew, old-time Sephardic Jew. Mensch is good.
Mm-hmm. Did you set out in your life with that kind of intention?
No, if I look at my early life, I think my intention was to be a heroin addict, because I was very successful at that. No, I grew up in a family, actually, with a lot of do-gooders, socialists and communists, labor organizers. And one of the starkest, earliest lessons I got was that the government would lie about you and your family and talk about these school teachers and labor organizers and civil rights workers like they were spies for Stalin. It took me a long time. I probably never saluted the flag after I was 12. And I realized that the forces of government and all the things you're supposed to look up to and cross your heart will sell you out in a minute if it works against their interests. So I grew up with a sense of righteousness driven into me and with a sense of selfless dedication. What is that noise?
I think it might be gardeners outside. Oh. Let's ignore it.
Oh, yeah, the curse of North America, the Mexican with a weed whacker. I don't mean that against immigrants, by the way. I mean it against weed whackers.
You saved me from having to edit that.
Anyway, so I grew up with this idea of service and doing stuff for the good of everyone. And that sort of stuck, and I had a lot of problems getting there along the way, and I took some detours into drugs and the counterculture for a long time. I regret the drugs. I don't regret the counterculture at all. And I took 10 years off just to think about the world and what I believed in and what I wanted to do. So when I settled in and had to go to work and stuff, I knew what I was working for. I didn't regret it. I never had a midlife crisis or anything. So I think that I saw menschness modeled by the men and women in my family and their friends. I saw adults, you know, broken and weeping in my living room, having been thrown out of their job for refusing to snitch on a friend they were in the Communist Party 15 years earlier with, before they realized they'd been sold a bill of goods and left. Norman Thomas, candidate for vice president, wound up grooming French poodles. You know, Albert Dekker, great Broadway actor, done. God knows what happened to him. So I grew up with both a sense of outrage and a sense of service.
So all that was a vestige, a later part of the McCarthy era and the Red Scare era?
Yeah, late 1950s. Yeah. You know, what happened was at the end of World War II, the United States realized it was going to be in competition with the Soviet Union ideologically and for world resources. And instead of just explaining it to the people, they just did a knee-jerk thing. We're going to turn the people against communism, which was just a political philosophy. You know, the only place it might be working partially is China, but I've never seen a communist government that was worth anything. But they equated and conflated socialism and communism and leftism and progressivism, and they just made a reflex of combining those things with evil. So that today we can't address any of our problems For instance, what do we do in a culture that's based around money? What do we do with things that don't make money? What do we do with daycare for working parents? What do we do with free medical health that all of our allies have managed? So we're just stuck in this rut, and we got a political system that's a wholly owned subsidiary of capital, and we're just all paralyzed, and people are going to the mat to grab the last little crumbs before it all goes over the cliff.
Pretty well said. You're kind of good with words. Anybody ever mention that?
Well, I'm a writer. That's what I really do.
So part of that story, the writer story, you born and raised in New York, correct?
Raised in Englewood, New Jersey, and the Delaware Water Gap of Pennsylvania.
Okay. And at some point, you had an opportunity to go to the Iowa Writers Conference or to work to Iowa State or the Writers Program there?
Well, I went to college in Grinnell, Iowa,
right,
which is a kind of nifty liberal arts school. Mm-hmm. I went kicking and screaming, but it turned out to be the best thing for me. Mm-hmm. I met my four oldest friends, three of whom are dead now. All of us were going to be writers. We all did. And the Iowa Writers Workshop accepted me as a writer when I applied for graduate school. But I had spent 4 years in Iowa, and the last year was 20 below zero for 3 weeks. So I went to San Francisco. I got accepted there, and I went to pursue a master's with a poet that I liked very much named Robert Duncan.
And that's a kind of a seminal moment, it would seem, in your story, that instead of staying in Iowa or even going back to New York, a literary center, you chose the West Coast, and everything was different after that, wasn't it?
Well, I chose being as far away from my family as I could be. I had some real difficulties with my dad. It took me a long time to understand who he was. I'm not sure he ever understood who I was. And I just felt like being there was suffocating. It's like being locked in a closet with Medusa. So I did better when I was far away. And after a couple of years in the West, I just took a deep sigh of relief and relaxed and just became a part of this country.
And you've lived here ever since, really?
Ever since 1964.
Yeah. And you make your home in Marin County?
Well, I was in the city for a while. I studied Zen at San Francisco Zen Center for about 8 years. Then I moved to Marin, and I lived there for almost 40 years. And then in around 2014, I got divorced. And when we carved up our house, I couldn't buy a garage in Mill Valley. So I just started looking. And I wound up in Sebastopol, which was right where I'm supposed to be.
There you go. If the voice you're hearing sounds familiar, it's probably because you've heard narrations by Peter Coyote. If you haven't, then you're not watching the quality documentaries, I'd say. How did the decision to get into the world of theater come to you? And you approached it not as most people typically do, like, I want to be a star, but you had more of an ideological goal in mind, right?
It's called hunger was my ideological goal. So I was always interested in acting, even as a teenager. And when I went to college, I had the good fortune to meet a remarkable guy named Ned Donahoe, a big Irish rogue of a drama teacher. His parents had been the warders of an insane asylum, and he had grown up with the inmates as his playmates. And he had about the loosest wig of anybody I've ever met. And he was half in the bag most of the time. And he dropped into my little circle in Grinnell Student Union, the black turtleneck, sweater, camel cigarette, poetry crowd. And he dropped in and he said, I suppose it's never occurred to you that theater is a public argument of great moment played out before a crowd. And I said, no. As a matter of fact, it never occurred to me. He said, well, if you had any balls, you'd come and you auditioned for my theater company. So I did. And what he did was he put together a little company in this college. And he said, The goddamn basketball coach doesn't use his second string team. Why should I? And I got this unprecedented opportunity to work for 4 years, two or three plays a year, doing stuff that you'd never be cast at. You know, Long Day's Journey Into Night, James Jr. And you could stand behind Ned Donahoe in the wings, watching his actors. And just by watching his body, you could see every emotional beat of every speech. It was astounding. And I was so taken by him that many years later, after I was somewhat famous, I went back to the school to fight for him keeping his job. And they let him go. And I said, you know, you can get another button-down, letter-perfect kind of guy, but you're never going to get the spark of genius that you have in this man. And trust me, he's worth the trouble. I mean, the money I've made alone and paid in taxes would pay his salary for a number of years. But they didn't have the courage to do that. So when I got to California, there was a theater company called the Actors Workshop. And the two guys who started it, Blau and Irving, Henry Blau and Jules Irving, were quite well known as avant-garde theater people. And they were pulled to New York to start Lincoln Center. And they brought their best actors with them. And I came in at a kind of defunct period. It was just like holding on by the roots. And a lot of mincing around in tights and, you know. Anyway, we did a show, a world premiere of Edward III, which was about a gay mad king by Bertolt Brecht. And we had a second theater, a little theater down on Mason Street. And I walked by there and there was this little theater company there called the San Francisco Mime Troupe. And they had blown up newspaper articles about them. Looked like so much fun. They were out in the park, gorgeous women with low-cut décolletage. And anyway, I just marked them. And I thought, I'll do something like that for my theater. So I was an amateur photographer. I took 80 photographs and blew them up and mounted them of our stage building. We had built a huge circular stage that had to be turned by galley slaves in the back. And I took 80 photographs and put them all over the lobby. And the theater company was a big success and nobody mentioned them, said thank you, anything. So I went to see this mime troupe company in the park. And I saw the two most beautiful women I'd ever seen in my life. To this day, they were just drop-dead, crippling, beautiful. Kay Hayward and Sandy Archer. Sandy Archer, God bless her. She's gone, but Kay's still alive and kicking. And I went down there, and I just was thrilled. I was wearing like a three-piece suit, and I went into this little funky company. And Ronnie Davis, who's like a little Jewish speed freak, trust fund Marxist, he and I hit it off. We were just like battling heads, and Sandy Archer was his old lady, and she's typing there. She's not saying a word, and I'm just checking out of the corner of my eye, like, how am I doing, man? Tick, tick, tick. And so he turns and says, Sandy, what do you think about this guy? She said, he talks a lot. So he took me out to meet the star actor, a guy named John Robb. Big, tall, hickory stick of a guy with a chiseled face. Fantastic actor. Had half a Pall Mall stuck behind his ear. And he takes it out and lights it. And Ronnie introduces me. He looks me up and down in my fucking stupid suit and 13 shoes, you know. And he says, pretty fancy for the mime troupe, isn't he? Anyway. That was the start of stepping out into the counterculture. And that was a high and fine time. And we traveled the country as revolutionary actors and sleeping with co-eds and spreading the word and getting arrested in Denver. We went on trial for 10 days for lewd and immoral acts in public. My favorite line from that trial was a witness for the prosecution who said, sex is either holy or in the home. Anyway, they arrested us in Denver in a 1,200-seat auditorium that had six judges and about 10 lawyers. And this was a show called The Minstrel Show, which was probably the most radical theater event I've ever been in. Three black guys, three white guys, all in black face makeup, Afro wigs, sky blue tuxedos, white gloves. And it started off like an old-fashioned minstrel show, little racist opera. And about 10 minutes in, we had this Marlboro Man interlocutor, white boy in a tuxedo. And about 10 minutes in, they tied him up. And then the minstrels started doing something called Negro History Week, which came straight out of Malcolm X. And Harry Belafonte and Nipsey Russell came to our studio once and saw this show, and they fell out. And they called Dick Gregory, and Dick Gregory invited us to New York. And so we traveled the country doing tours and did that show. Anyway, it was hard to come down from that. But at a certain point, two guys from New York came out, Emmett Grogan and Billy Murcott. And the germ of the Diggers was spread. Because these guys said, yeah, you guys are great, man. You guys are doing really good stuff, but you could do more. You own the stage. Even if a drunk gets up on stage, you can improv, you can drop him off, but you're not bringing other people onto the stage with you. What about using your acting talents to create theater events that people don't know are theater, that have them question profit and private property and what they're doing with their lives? And that engaged a whole bunch of us. And the whole bunch of people from the mime troupe became the Diggers. And the Diggers idea was, we were not lefties particularly. In the 60s, the model for liberation was Mao and the left and the Little Red Book. And we were artists. I didn't want to have to do plays about heroic elevator operators. I wanted to be authentic to myself. So our job was to imagine a world we wanted to live in and make it real by acting it out. And our hunch was that Americans were never going to throw themselves on the barricades to be the lumpen proletariat. But if they had a life that they liked, they might protect it. So we began by just feeding the runaways and all the people in the Haight-Ashbury. We tried going to the farmer's market. The Italians wouldn't give us anything. So we sent the women nursing babies, and they gave us enough food to feed 600 people a day. And all they had to do to get it was to step through a 6-foot by 6-foot yellow rectangle of 2x4s, which we call the free frame of reference. Just bring a spoon and a bowl, and we'd feed them. And we fed people for over a year that way. And then other churches took it over. And then we set up the first free medical clinic. We started a free store where you could get tools, clothes, bicycles, furniture, television, everything worked. And it was free. And everything was free. So if you came in and you said, who's in charge here? I'd say, you are. And if you just dropped your jaw, you know, and looked stupid, there was no sense blaming the pigs or the system or the anything. You'd been given a chance to create your own reality. So, but if you said, I'm in charge. Well, I hate the way this crap is done. Let's do this. And we'd do it. And we'd redo it. And the subtext of the free store was to say, okay, why do you want to become an employee to make the money to become a consumer? We'll give you the stuff. Now, what do you want to do with your life? And that extended all the way even to having impeccably perfect draft cards. And we had all the codes. We knew if it was from Georgia, what the code was supposed to be. And San Francisco was a shipping point for soldiers out to Vietnam. So kids would come in uniform. And the word got out, and with a little delicate hooing and hawing, Billy from Arkansas might leave his Bobby from Nebraska hanging his uniform up in the rack. We told him always, keep the boots. Keeping the boots and going out in jeans and stuff, disappearing out into the world. They didn't kill anybody. They didn't get murdered. And they got a new chance.
Wow.
So we did that for a couple years. And then we kind of thought, you know, my highest aspiration in life is not running a soup kitchen. So then we began moving out and setting up strings of communes, meeting the native people around who we figured were the encyclopedias of how to live in this place, and developing systems of trade and sustenance. We had no money. The only money that came in was for mothers with children. They could get enough to maybe, let's say the rent was $100 a month. Well, they'd get $200 a month. So that'd do rent and electricity and a little bit. And the men had to hustle everything else. Food, trucks, figure out how to make it happen. And, you know, you got me going. I don't even remember what the question was.
But not that, important anymore.
Oh, yeah, no, it was. It was theater. So when all this ended, long story, a lot of crazy times. My daughter's mother had run away. I was a single father. My father had died so far below broke, it was silly. My mother had to sell three homes. We were evicted from our family farm. And many of the communes broke down because we didn't own the land, or kids grew up and the parents had to move closer to school. But we still stayed together as a family. The diggers, there's still 108 diggers on the network chipping in money every month to give $200 a month to about 15 or 16 of our people that got old and indigent. Just a little grace on top of whatever Social Security, whatever they get. So I wound up back in San Francisco bringing my daughter to see her mother about 2 years later. And I was below broke. I had nothing to do. I just had no idea. And I went and I applied for a CETA job. And there's a guy named John Kreidler who very brilliantly took the Comprehensive Education and Training Act, that's CETA, and he created a niche in it for artists. And when I went down to try out for it, there were 1,000 people in line for 100 jobs. And I didn't even know what it was. I just saw a friend of mine. I got in line with him. And I went into a room, and there was a guy there named Stephen Goldstein, who in my book is a huge hero in my life, got me a fresh start, because I went in there and he said, I didn't know it's an audition. I didn't bring a guitar. I didn't bring anything. He said, well, do something. I said, okay. So I used to be a drummer. So I started a good conga rhythm, and I just made up a rap about being out of work and broke and made it rhyme and just made it funny. And they hired me. So I went from making maybe $2,000 a year to making $600 a month, figuring out what I was going to do. And about 2 months after I got that job, my friend Gary Snyder, a poet, won the Pulitzer Prize. And Jerry Brown tapped him to create a state arts council of all working artists. And Gary tapped me to help him. And after a number of stumbles, we made a huge success of it. We turned this little $1 million agency into an $18 million agency. We had artists working as problem solvers for the state instead of giving the money to make art, which the conservatives would have hated. We said artists are creative problem solvers. And we had agreements with 14 different agencies. Artists were making movies about teenage pregnancy. Artists were writing historical dramas for the parks. Artists were doing signage. Dancers were working with senior citizens. People were teaching illiterate convicts how to work with their hands and do other things. And it was just a huge success. And I realized that I had learned, there's one funny story, I had learned how to talk to everybody. I didn't have to stay in the counterculture anymore. The Republicans had tried for years and years to shut us down, and little by little, after I stopped being so mean and hostile, I just went and sat down with all of them. We talked about dogs and hunting and fishing and farm life, and they covered my butt. They saw that I and the council were serious. I was the chairman for 4 years until they passed a law saying I couldn't do it anymore. So my last hearing in front of the Senate Finance Committee, It was like the Mount Rushmore of conservatives. Three guys from the Central Valley, just killers. But they had saved my butt for the last 4 years. They would override the legislative analyst. They would give me what we had asked for. And then they would vote against me on the record to save their butt after they knew I was through. So I'm coming up for my last hearing. And just before they start, they reach under the table and they all put on hippie headbands. And I'm telling you, I almost burst into tears because they were just saying, good job, kid. And on the basis of that, I said, I'm going to give myself 5 years to try the movies. It was the only marketable skill I possibly had. I was 39 years old when I got my SAG card, 40 before I was in a movie of any account. And while I wasn't the greatest actor in the world, I was competent and I worked really hard and I was organized and I'd already been studying Buddhism for 5 years. So I could let a lot of stuff go off my back. And, you know, it got me a great life and it got me a lot of travel and a lot of money for a while until you get divorced twice and cut everything in half twice. But as soon as my kids graduated from grad school with no debt, I retired and went back to what I always loved to do, which was write. So I've written 5 books and I do a lot of narrations for Ken Burns. I've done 14 for him and I do a lot of freebie documentaries for good causes. And I live on my little farm in Sebastopol and I come in here and talk to Barry.
It's a really wonderful opportunity. It's such a lifetime. I mean, you think about what you want to be looking back at. You're 82 now, is that right?
Thanks a lot.
What do you want to be looking back at when you're 82? And it makes me sad to think there are a lot of people who don't have a whole lot there, you know? And you've managed to do so many things all with this intention of making a difference, right? That's really the underlying thing. You did some things to make money, but all the time you were trying to make a difference. True?
Well, I think there were two things. I don't want to sound, you know, like Jesus, but one of the things was I was always a victim of my curiosity. If I got curious about something, you could not stop me from doing it. And so whether those were ideas or whether those were people or whether those were bad women, it just didn't matter. A friend of mine said to me once, said, Peter, if she had high cheekbones and long legs, you'd follow an axe murderess into a butcher shop. And that was true, actually. And I had some problems to work out with women, which I did. And but so it wasn't all that I was just a good guy. But I still have this sense of outrage about bullies, sense of outrage about a Congress that is incapable of acting because they're so wholly owned by money and no one will talk about, let's say, full federal funding of elections where every candidate gets the same amount, or prohibiting corporations from spending their tax deductible money to alter public policy for their shareholders, not for the people. And finally, to outlaw gifts from lobbyists to legislators. We'd have different people in Washington and they'd be free to set policy and act. And when you look at it, and from the time that the news became private in the early 60s, news used to be non-public. That's when we had Edward R. Murrow and Huntley Brinkley and those great guys. And the president of CBS said to his reporters, don't worry about money. I got Jack Benny to make money. And the CBS News was like the hood ornament on a Rolls Royce. As soon as it went private, every producer in the world, when Dateline opened is what it was, and it started bringing huge revenues to the corporate parent, they changed the news into profit centers. They got younger and hipper broadcasters, you know, talking heads, and they started going for the biggest circle around the planet, the equator. Well, that's the mean IQ. That meant every argument had to be dumbed down. You got rid of nuance. And the prevalent strategy is keeping people's eyeballs there for the sponsors. So everything becomes a horse race. Who's winning? Who's losing? It's tension. This is about to happen. That's about to happen. We got a poll. We got a this. He's up. He's down. Nobody knows anything because it's hard to find not an unbiased source of news, but a profound source. So I watch the BBC, or I watch Al Jazeera, or I watch Amy Goodman on PBS, because much as I like and respect all the people at MSNBC, I mean, they're brilliant people, but it's all operating with a kind of hysteria. It's just all at a fever pitch, and it's all just so entertaining and all just so smart, but there's not a behavioral option that you come up with. Whose side are you on, the Jews or the Palestinians? Wait, are those the only two options? Mm-hmm. Really? That's all I've got? So is it any wonder that that 70 million people voted for Donald Trump? No, it's not, because from the time Reagan came in and killed the fairness doctrine in broadcasting, which forced TV stations using the public airwaves to show every side of an issue, mandated. And if you talked badly about somebody on the air, that person got to come on the same show and defend themselves. So we've had, since 1968, when Lewis Powell wrote his white paper, laying out a blueprint to take the country away from the liberals and the Richard Scaife Mellon and the Koch brothers and Coors, put up millions and millions of dollars, set up the Heritage Foundation, set up all these think tanks. They've moved America little by little by little right of center. And nobody knows how. They put some guy from a think tank on the air. They never tell you what its philosophy is, who funded it. So, you know, it's like, Mr. Hitler wants to kill 6 million Jews. Mr. Schwartz wants none. Let's start with 3 million and discuss it from there. So, you know, I just stay at kind of a low boil all the time. And I just wrote a 40-page piece on the history of Lewis Powell, where that cohort put Ronald Reagan into the presidency, who declared government the enemy. He brought Pat Buchanan in, which brought in the evangelicals and the militias. That brought Newt Gingrich in, who called the Democrats evil. And then even Bill Clinton, Robert Rubin, and Larry Summers turned the Democratic Party into a neoliberal party to chase the Wall Street money and the hedge fund money. And in that process, all the urban and rural blue-collar people were abandoned, and they wound up being the foot soldiers for the invasion of the Capitol. So I put all this together, and there's a brilliant young guy named Jan Friel, who started a Wikipedia site called Observer Wikipedia, which is a kind of left-wing progressive Wikipedia, and we're going to record this, and we're going to build a documentary around it with AI to illustrate it and put it on YouTube. Maybe a couple hundred thousand people will see it. But other than that, I write letters, you know. Santa Rosa Press Democrat writes my letters. I send them to the New York Times. They don't publish them. You know,
New York Times has changed.
Keeps me off the street.
Yeah. What an astonishing description of so many things. You were talking earlier about the Red Scare and the labeling people as communists. And one of the interesting outcomes of this arc of political persuasion, I guess you could say, we now have people on the right who will call you a communist and a fascist in the same sentence, which I always want to like pause that and say, do you understand you're talking about two diametrically different things when they do that?
They understand. All they know is that to the public, it means evil.
Yeah.
It means bad. You know, Jay Leno. Jay Leno used to send camera crews out to college campuses and video talking to college kids and saying, who were the enemies in World War II? They have no idea. Who won the Civil War? They have no idea. Name two members of Congress. What's the name of the vice president? They don't teach civics anymore. No. And so on the one hand, it's great because the people are so manipulative and so easy to move around. But what are stupid people going to make that the rest of the world wants to buy?
Wow, that's a good one. I think what you said earlier about curiosity is something that we've lost. Younger people today, if they become curious, it's not about anything important. You know what I mean? It's curiosity about a celebrity's outfits or who they're dating. It's curiosity about insane conspiracy theories like the we never went to the moon and things like that. It's the wrong kind of, it's a misguided curiosity instead of look how much there is to actually know about the planet, human history, and so on.
So I don't know, do you attribute that to some single or complex cause?
I don't know. Screens, television screens leading into computer screens, leading into the smartphone, to where young people grow up without, I don't feel like parents today are, and I have to be the old guy saying parents, the parents, but some kind of basic idea that you are expected to learn things.
Yes.
You know, one of the most prized possessions in my humble home growing up in Missouri was a set of the Encyclopedia Britannica.
Me too.
And my dad had brought that in for wherever he got it. I don't know, because he didn't have any money to buy things, but it was always there. And then my mother became a salesperson for the World Book Encyclopedia.
I remember them too.
With the goal of earning a set of the World Book. And so we had eventually both of those. And I was a kid who would just pull out a random volume and start to read things.
Me right? too.
And that enriched my life tremendously from the age I could read.
I would ask my father a question and he'd point to the encyclopedia or the dictionary. And you know, about 20 years ago, I bought a full set of the 9th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica, which had Einstein in it, Wittgenstein in it, Linus Pauling, all these great minds. I kept it just mostly there on my shelves for 25 years, just like an old friend. Mm-hmm. I have another idea about curiosity.
Okay.
So one of the things that when we were young, when we were arguing about the Vietnam War, and I was part of the first and only picket group that was ever invited into the White House. I was part of a 3-day fast in front of the White House right after the Cuban Missile Crisis. A group called the Grinnell 14, and we strategized and behaved so well that Kennedy invited us in, and it was a big deal. Jamie Raskin, who's Marcus Raskin, who was Jamie Raskin's father, came running into our rooming house to tell us what a big deal it was. And we wrote to 100 schools, and we kept other students there for a year, and that led to the first 25,000 student demonstration in Washington in 1963. So we felt we had agency. One of the things I learned talking to McGeorge Bundy, looking at that guy who was like my dad, he was a pirate. And I realized he didn't give a shit about us. We were a problem to be solved for his president. And the only way you were going to get that guy's attention was to come with an army. And I had hopes later on, a couple of years later, that the army might be the counterculture. Not necessarily a violent army, but something that they couldn't ignore. Well, now when I look and I see kids that have pierced their eyebrows and they got things through their cheeks and through their noses, and every time I talk to them, I'm surprised at how sweet they are. And I realize that they are showing me their suffering. They feel whipped. They feel like they don't have agency because they've learned, I don't care what the propaganda is, our political system is organized around the collecting and dispersing of money. And there's nothing you can't get for $100,000. And these kids know it. These kids know that when 80% of the people want reasonable gun laws and nothing happens, that the Congress is working for the 20%. So you can tell them everything you want. They just see through it all. That's why so many people are abandoning democracy. It's not serving them. And the Democrats, well, they share more of what they steal, but they're still, it's just the same, give me the money. Every day I get 100 tin cups waved on my iPhone, mm-hmm. saying, oh my God, Biden's going down. Oh, just let me, give me a second. Mm-hmm. It's humiliating. It's disgusting. I lived in Europe for years and years, and I went there on my honeymoon recently to Paris and London. And my wife and I were saying, people are so relaxed here. People are not screaming at each other. My God, they got the same issues, but nobody's calling the others evil. No, they're not machine guns on the street. You don't have to worry when you go into a theater that, you know, crazy Eddie's going to show up with an AK-47. So, I mean, we have just traded this golden kingdom. Instead of just spreading the parameters to include more people and give everybody a fair shot, it's now like we're rats, overcrowded rats in a cage fighting for the last kernels of corn. It's not going well.
That's a pretty down note on which to end, but we have to. And I would ask you, would you come back and do another part two with me sometime?
Oh, yeah. Can you bear to hear my voice another 5 minutes?
Next time around, you'll know exactly where we are. You won't
I
get
will
lost.
Know. All right. I will.
Peter Coyote has been my guest in the Berry Pod, and I can't thank you enough. It's an absolute pleasure.
So much fun.
This one recorded on May the 6th, 2024.
You're listening to The Berry Pod, tastings from Wine Country Live in the morning.
On 99.3, thevine.com.